Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me is my co-host, Steve. How are you doing?
John, how are you? I'm good.
Going up and down with the stock market, but not as much as some people. It's pretty shocking, this new Robinhood article that came out in the New York Times yesterday.
I saw that, yeah. Pretty bonkers story that kind of went into some of the practices that Robinhood has created in their app that have made it maybe not a great product if you're not a very sophisticated investor.
Yeah, it's like giving a hammer to someone that works in a China shop, I guess. Yeah, you can really do some damage. But some of the stats were pretty surprising. Robinhood users trade 9 times as many shares as E-Trade customers. I'm an E-Trade customer, so now I feel conservative compared to that. But I'm not obsessively looking over the latest emoji or something. And then They trade 40 times as many shares as Schwab customers.
I saw that. Yeah, I think that I think a lot of that is just people who maybe need an outlet if you have sort of a gambling mentality and you want to gamble on some stuff or you just need to play a game. People are kind of releasing that tension, if you will, via Robinhood, which is not a good recipe, I think.
Well, it's just too gamified, right? It gives you the little prompts to trade more. Or it gives you the little confetti. It's those emojis. Those emojis are addictive.
It's the emojis, yeah. For some more context here, there's an article in the New York Times that kind of profiled this guy from San Diego who essentially got in trouble, or who got in debt, I think up to $900K in debt because he was just playing with Robinhood so much. He ended up taking a home equity loan in his house and doing all these very, admittedly irresponsible things, but he felt like he was trapped by the experience and sort of the dopamine hits that you get when you invest with the app. And also, this is all comes, of course, at the heels of the suicide that happened a few weeks ago with this kid who didn't quite understand how settlement works, ended up thinking that he was massively in debt and committed suicide after being over-leveraged on the app. So, very, very interesting read.
And during this time where the stock market is so volatile, actually all the markets are so volatile, commodities, you saw oil prices go negative. I mean, all kinds of crazy things can happen right now, in other words. You have to be ready for, or at least make sure that you haven't taken a third mortgage on your house. And it looks like the incentives based on, the article, and well, it's just a lot of numbers about how Robinhood makes more money from high frequency trading firms. And just a quick background, almost all of the brokerages sell their trade volumes to high frequency trade, or I should say private pools, dark pools. These are private exchanges, and high frequency traders need a lot of volume to do what they do, to basically front run you and take a tiny bit off of each trade. And Robinhood makes more on that revenue stream than TD Ameritrade, E-Trade, or Schwab, or other people. So they have a huge incentive to churn those accounts, to get people trading as much as possible. So that whole gamification and, emoji stuff is not just to make it cute. It's part of the revenue model, the profit model for Robinhood.
It is, yeah. It's sort of that old adage, right? If it's free, you're the product.
Or if you think it's too good to be true, probably is. Free trades.
Yes. Free trades.
Yeah, and it's not just the revenue stream. And that's right, you're the product. Robinhood has also had problems with their site going down. So in addition to being perhaps over-leveraged, relying on these very volatile trades where people are trying to anyway, time the market, get in and out, Robinhood's site has gone down 47 times since March. As they're encouraging you to do all this, the thing just disappears on you sometimes on top of it all.
Yeah, I think famously they had a massive outage when the PPP loans were announced, or some sort of financial relief was announced, which basically meant that people didn't benefit from the bounce back in the market, which is not ideal.
We have Charles Yu, an angel investor, here to join us this week on the podcast. So we're really lucky to have you, Charles. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Stephen, John.
So why don't you tell us about what you've been doing lately and what investments look interesting to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So quick background on myself. I manage an angel fund, and I'm also a venture principal at Bloom Capital, which is a seed stage venture firm based in San Francisco. Prior to this, I was a fund of funds investor as well as a fintech growth stage investor. Today, I spend most of my time on seed stage deals and sometimes the occasional fund investment as well. I'm focused a lot on fintech just because my background in the past has been centered on it. So made a few fintech bets recently. And I think even among this like COVID investment environment, there's plenty of deals to be done, and a lot of interesting founders still pop up.
So not bets, but solid investments into very capable business plans.
Yes, at least that's what I think so. I hope so.
Hopefully.
That's the philosophy. Yeah. Hey, Charles, I'm curious. What aspects of fintechs are you more interested in now? Is it more the consumer space? Is it lending or RedTech? Sort of what drives you, or what do you see rather as being an interesting space to invest now in fintech?
Yeah, absolutely. One theme that I'm interested in is payments and analytics for offline payments, specifically brick and mortar stores. I think today the majority of your time is spent online, but 87% of all purchases still happen offline. So every online company we know runs like advanced analytics on their payments. They know who their repeat customers are, who their churn customers are, what the average ticket size is. But when you look at the average coffee shop, they don't have the tools necessary to make those decisions. Or have any of these advanced analytics. So I think companies like Square have done a great job. They've been successful because they can combine the payments portion with analytics, but they've only touched the surface of the market. Most brick and mortar merchants are still in the dark here. So that's one theme that I'm interested in. I've seen several companies have made bets in the past around it. Another would be in lending, specifically alternative ways to get a little bit more specific into education, alternative ways to pay for your tuition. And I recently made a bet in the ISA space.
So this is your investment in Trusted Insight, right? Can you tell us what the deal is with Trusted Insight and sort of what their product does?
Yeah, absolutely. Trusted Insight is a LP network, but they also run a fund of funds program. They're about $650 million under management. They're half of which is dedicated to a fund of funds program. The other half is dedicated to a fintech growth stage fund. And I had a great experience there, sort of working on both sides of the platform. On the fund of funds side, I was assessing emerging VC managers, typically the first check into the first-time managers in the venture space. On the growth stage investment fintech side, I was making bets typically at the Series B, Series C round all over the world. So we were geographically agnostic. We had made some bets in India, a couple in the United States, one in Europe, and had a great experience on both sides of the ecosystem there.
Interesting. One company that you recently invested in is actually TradeUp, which, as I mentioned before, trades in the ISA space, which is basically income sharing agreements. Can you walk us, maybe for our listeners who may be unfamiliar, what an income sharing agreement is and what TradeUp is doing that's different in the space?
Absolutely. So TradeUp is a personal investment of mine. I had invested personal money back in March. They were a YC Winter 2020 inside the YC Winter 2020 cohort. TradeUp, what they do is originate income sharing agreements for trade school students. What an income sharing agreement is an alternative way of financing your tuition. You don't pay anything up front, but when you get a job, you pay a certain percent of your income every year, up to a certain amount or a certain time frame to whoever gave you that loan in the first place. And it's a good way of not paying a large sum up front if it's past your means. And I think it's extremely beneficial for an industry to just have different payment methods instead of traditional student loans, which are predatory. And I can walk through kind of the details around how TradeUp structures them specifically.
Yeah, I actually would love to learn more. So there was actually a pretty prominent article maybe about 6 months ago or so in New York Magazine that highlighted some issues people had with Lambda School, which is another ISA provider. But I think that Lambda School was focused mostly on sort of UX type work, right? So it wasn't exactly vocational or trade school. So it sounds like for TradeUp, you're looking more at, you know, X-ray technicians or dental assistants or what type of jobs are or what type of careers rather do people who go through the TradeUp platform get coverage for?
Definitely. So we all know Lambda School, Hack Reactor. These programs have done ISAs for computer science and data science specifically, but the market for trade schools is much larger. These jobs include being like a diesel mechanic, a dental assistant, etc. And the ROI on these programs is much larger because there's a higher demand for these jobs than what's currently supplied. So there are definitely a greater need for dental assistants than computer scientists. We all know the computer scientist job market is growing fast, but it's still not to the scale as most of these trade school roles. What TradeUp does is they partner with trade schools with the highest placement rates as the main acquisition channel. So they're only originating the loans. And these trade schools have longtime partnerships with employers and help TradeUp do the marketing. The reason why this is different than Lambda School is Lambda School typically hires the teachers and they run the educational programs, and they're responsible for the graduation rates of these students and helping these students find jobs right after the program. TradeUp in this case doesn't need to worry about all of those logistics. They're simply partnering with the best schools that have 98% plus graduation rates. So that's already one advantage over Lambda School in terms of graduation rates specifically. The second is typically if you're going out for like a computer science degree, for let's say one of these like boot camps, it's about $30,000 out of pocket if you want to pay in cash. If you take their ISA program, you're doing about 17% of your annual salary for 2 years. So let's say you're making $140,000 as a software engineer. That's almost $50,000 you're paying towards Lambda School in 2 years.
Wow.
With trade schools, the tuition is much lower. It's $10,000 loan instead of $30,000. And there's a cap on the ISA. So you don't pay any more than $15,000. And that's spread across a 7-year term. So it's much more friendly because the principal is much lower. In addition, these students see a 15 to 20% bump in their salary as soon as they graduate from these trade schools. And that's on top of the guaranteed employment rate, which is at 98%. So just going to pause here and happy to answer any like specific details around that.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think that the whole issue with the Lambda School is that it's much more difficult to go from, say, being a bartender to a data scientist, right? That seems like a very wide gulf to bridge. Whereas if you go from, say, a bartender to like an X-ray technician or a dental assistant, that seems like a much more feasible, achievable thing. And also this gets into a number of issues that I'm really interested in. One of them being sort of the student loan crisis and how that's just ballooning up. And I think that the more we take on the German model of creating a pipeline for, you know, trade schools and actual, you know, trades like plumbing and dental hygienist, the better off we'll be. And I think we can possibly reduce the effects of student loans and the burdens on that on this crop of new kids. And it also sounds like you're de-risking the process by not getting involved in actually in the placement and the teaching, but just in the funding of it by itself, right?
That's exactly right. And something else to add is the market. When we make bets at the seed stage, we look at the size of the market and how big and fragmented it is. For trade schools, there were over 20 million students enrolled in trade schools 5 years ago. That stat still needs to be updated for 2020, but there's real no competitors in the ISA space for trade schools today. They're all focused on like what we discussed, Lambda School, Hack Reactor's all focused on like computer science and like these new high paying jobs, but there's definitely a higher demand for these trade school roles. If you do the analysis, they need less than 1% of the market to hit 100 million in net revenue. That's sort of the back pocket analysis we do as investors. We look at the market size and then we say, how much do we need to hit 100 million in net revenue, which roughly equates to $1 billion in valuation. And if the number is very small, then we know the market is large enough to enter here.
Amazing. In terms of ISAs as well, I know that they've been deployed at places like Purdue, right? Are there any other schools that are doing any sort of ISA-like agreement that you know of?
I think there are a couple of schools popping up. Purdue is one big one that you mentioned. The problem I have with like ISAs for traditional four-year programs is, again, the principal is really high. So for a lot of these private schools, you might be paying 40, 50K a year in tuition. After 4 years, you might have an ISA as big as 200K. Of course, they probably put constraints on it, but if you think about the compared to principal ISA amount of a trade up versus a four-year tuition program, it's much more friendly. It's like 10K versus maybe 50 to 100K. And when you have that big of a principal amount, you're stuck paying that over a longer term period. And it sort of becomes like a student loan. The reason why people can't get from being under these student loans is because the principal amount is so large that they continue to pay it like 10 years down the line. So
or
10. You can restructure for even a 30 year term. So that's my main issue. I think ISAs is a great alternative use of paying tuition, but it has to be done in the right way. And there has to be student caps. So for trade up, they cap at 1.5x. You never pay more than, if the average tuition is 10K, you never pay more than 15K. And I think that's a lot more fair to the student.
Yeah, this is a really interesting area. Yeah, what kind of schools have, or maybe they're in certain regions where there's a high demand that have this 98% placement rate? That seems a great program to go into, but I imagine that's not every region and for every kind of trade.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what TradeUp is doing at the moment, they're still early on in their journey, is they want to partner up with the top schools with the highest graduation rates. And so they're assessing which schools they partner up with and specifically which regions to go after. The key here is to show good rates on the first two cohorts of ISAs so they can continue scaling, raising maybe a debt fund from investors to continue financing more and more ISAs. So right now they're exclusive partnerships with three trade schools, but I know they're always looking for more. And the main criteria is one, partnerships with employers. So in many cases, in one school, for example, students can sign an employment agreement before they even graduate. Before they even enter the program. So let's say the program's 1 year in length. They have a job locked in before they even enter the program because the demand for these roles is so high and the school that they're entering to is so high quality that employers don't even care. As long as they graduate the program, they're willing to take any student that comes through those schools. And TradeUp's mission here is to partner with those high quality schools. And that's part of their business model and way to kind of keep defaults on these loans low and to ensure high IRR for their investors.
Yeah, I've seen that's part of the agreements when someone places a factory somewhere that they need training anyway. So like I think it was some of the German car companies when they went into Georgia, BMW and Mercedes are there. And they were either working with local community colleges or schools and providing funding, for their own benefit. So that makes perfect sense that they would need specialized training and they would have lots of jobs, especially when they're starting up. I love to see these businesses too that solve these pain points for small, medium-sized businesses that give them the kind of abilities that would be expensive or complicated for them to do otherwise. And I'm thinking of like the drip capital with the trade financing. You get a big order and you need the financing, and it looks like it does something to help out with that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And drip capital is an investment that I made back, that the firm TI made back when I was there, and I was quarterbacking the deal there. So for context, Drip Capital is a trade financing platform for small to medium-sized businesses in a cross-border trade finance specifically. So they bridge the capital gap between exporters that want to be paid upfront for shipments and importers that only want to pay when they have sold their stock. The company aggregates data from over 10 different data sources, and they're able to process thousands of data points around the buyer's historical information and credit rating. The main problem in this market is in emerging markets like India, certain parts of like Southeast Asia, over 50% of small to medium-sized businesses are rejected for trade financing loans by local banks because they don't have credit history. These banks traditionally need to evaluate like a set criteria of financial paperwork. In addition, they need collateral on their loans. So if you're a small to medium-sized business, you probably don't have your financials in order. That's just not what your priority is. And you probably don't have collateral starting out. In Southeast Asia alone, the market is $420 billion in small to medium-sized export volume, just to give you a sense of like how big it is, but how underserved the market is when it comes to trade financing. And Drip Capital bridges that gap. They partner with trade insurance companies. They're able to underwrite better than the banks in these emerging countries, and they really help. They help bridge that capital gap with exporters that can't afford to wait for net 60 payments, and they want to be paid immediately.
Interesting. So it sounds like you mentioned TradeUp and now Drip Capital. You also invest in some RegTech stuff, some lending. I'm wondering, do you have sort of a unifying investment philosophy for all these investments, or is it just based on the industry and the company that you come across?
Absolutely. So I'm a sector agnostic investor. There are certain themes that I'm particularly passionate about, but two things I focus on, at least at the seed stage right now, are the founder quality and the market. I think everything else is like you want to look at, but what you really need to land is how good the founder is. At the moment, my angel portfolio consists of 7 companies. About 80% of it are all second time, third time founders. You really want a founder who's done it before, who sort of learned the ropes on somebody else's dime, and who's proven to be able to scale and hire from 0 to 100. The second criteria is looking at the market. So just understanding how big the market is, and once you combine and how fast growing the sector is, and once you combine the two, you get a great company. Unstoppable founder in a large market typically creates great success.
Too bad you're looking at the founders. We had a great fintech podcast for you to invest in, but
I see. Yeah, absolutely.
The founders are terrible.
I didn't say that.
Interesting.
But No, we've heard that. Of course, that's going to drive it. You can have a great idea, but if you don't have the execution, the experience to make it happen, it's not going to go. Yeah.
Many times the idea actually changed. Like the top company in my portfolio, they pivoted from their original idea. It's really at the seed stage, there's so many variables that change, but the variable that stays constant most of the time, or most constant, is the founder. So you if you think about it, moving from seed stage to Series A, you're probably going through multiple iterations of the same idea or business model or market or etc. But the founder is the one who's making all those decisions. So that's all the reason why why it's more important to focus on the team at that stage.
Yeah, flexibility is so important. I mean, the world can totally change, like we've seen recently. Have you had some instances where management wasn't as flexible as you thought they would be?
Fortunately for my portfolio, all my founders, it's pretty smooth sailing across this climate at the moment. I would say in companies that I've invested in the past, not in my current portfolio, you know, the founders are great, but maybe they're just stuck in a sector it's kind of shut out of luck when COVID hits. You know, it's not the founder's fault. It's not the management team's fault. They executed perfectly, but the sector is just going downhill. A good example of this is the rental housing market. If you're Airbnb, Sonder, etc., no matter how good the management team is, there's only so much you can do to help your core business when travel and tourism drops significantly. I would say those are the cases that have most adverse effects on the portfolio. But I'm fortunate enough where I transitioned to invest in seed stage companies. And at this stage, it's more about product development and finding product market fit rather than kind of scaling and hitting certain like revenue metrics. So we're fairly insulated against COVID, but definitely keeping an eye out on all of the companies moving forward.
Well, being fairly insulated against COVID is really good these days. But yeah, there's only so much you can pivot, I suppose. If you're Airbnb, you can't just suddenly become designer face masks and scented hand sanitizers.
Definitely. That just goes to the point. It's like you can do everything right, but no one knows how or when it's going to happen. But if your industry goes down, it's kind of like poker. You can play every hand perfectly, but there's always a element of uncertainty and chance in it. Same thing with startups. Like you can have great founders in big markets executing perfectly, but when a catastrophe hits, you don't know where it's going to come from, and you just have to defend as well as you can. And it can happen to any company. So we're certainly monitoring all vitals on our portfolio companies.
Sure, sure. I know I play my poker games perfectly, and there's always a catastrophe. But you know, one thing we don't hear a lot of emphasis on with people we talk to on this podcast is the brick and mortar side of things. Now you mentioned that, you know, it seems like everybody is focused so much on the e-commerce side, but you see the opportunity for brick and mortar. They need those same capabilities just like everyone else then.
Yeah, absolutely. And a company that I'm particularly passionate about in brick and mortar is a company that that Trusted Insight had invested in. It's called Standard Cognition. It's a cashierless checkout company. So it's sort of going back to the themes that I was mentioning around analytics and payments. It's sort of meshing both of them together for brick and mortar companies. To give you a bit of context around what the company does is traditional cashierless checkout company, sort of like Amazon Go, but a lot more advanced capabilities. So you walk into a grocery store or a coffee shop, you pick out a few items, you walk out without waiting in line to pay for your to pay with your credit card, and then you get charged directly on the app. It's very much in the frontier tech space at the moment, and on the surface, it might seem like it's just a way to convenience the customer, but they really have the opportunity to change brick and mortar payments. If you never have to wait in line to pay with your credit card, you never have to pay that 2.75% processing fee, right? If you're being charged directly through the Standard Cognition app, and customers can connect their bank account directly, you can be paying a significantly smaller fee on that. So if merchants don't have to pay that processing fee off of credit cards, they're incentivized to continually scale this, adopt this technology. And happy to go into details around that, but I think it's a good example of a company that's doing something exponential to disrupt brick and mortar payments, such as replacing credit cards altogether. I think the time for, you know, Square has done a great job. They're going to be the last payments company that's going to be big. I don't think like these companies like Toast or Clover are ever going to reach as big of a market cap that Square's taking, because they're all focused on one thing. They just want to be the payment gateway for brick and mortar, but they don't actually focus on innovation around structure. And I think their improvements are only incremental, and Standard Cognition really has a chance to disrupt the entire industry here. And I know that seems like a wild bet, but it's something that I'm throwing out there.
Well, I know in some cases, those credit card fees can be extremely onerous compared to, like you were saying, connecting the bank account and doing like an EFT then, right?
Exactly. Especially for on the merchant side, they're paying, you know, 2.75% per right. transaction. In some cases, it's like 2.6 plus a flat fee, maybe like a dime per transaction. If you're a coffee shop that's selling $3 croissants and you're paying a dime, like a flat fee for each item, that really does add up. So it's a new way for merchants to really bypass those fees. Similar to how Venmo does peer-to-peer transactions with no fees, perhaps we can just pay through this Standard Cognition app without having to go through the traditional credit card processing payment fees.
Interesting. So I know that the Amazon Go stores basically work in a similar way, but it's more based on sort of sensors and using the Amazon app, but they still run on credit cards. Any concern about maybe Amazon pushing into this space? Because I know they're making inroads into the financial services space, and it seems like they're a natural competitor, a natural scary giant competitor to get into this space.
To everybody. Yeah.
To everybody, basically. Yeah. The flywheel effect. Yeah.
Absolutely. They're definitely on the radar. They could be the incumbent in this space. I would say one technological advantage here is Amazon Go, as you alluded to, uses sensors beneath each item. So whenever you pick up like a can of tomatoes or something, it'll trigger a sensor that that somebody has that item in the store. That's very hardware and CapEx intensive. So Amazon Go stores are vetted specifically with that type of hardware. I don't think that's viable for traditional brick and mortar stores like coffee shops. They won't have the capital to pay for that OpEx or CapEx. Standard Cognition, on the other hand, everything's vision based. So they just, and it's controlled entirely through cameras and machine vision. You just have to install standard cameras at around your store, and the app takes over. You don't have to change the infrastructure of your store. You don't have to install sensors beneath every aisle. So I think Amazon Go is very much for Amazon, and they can do a great job with Amazon specific stores, but Standard Cognition, I think, will be the right approach for traditional merchants, small, medium-sized merchants to adopt.
For everybody else.
For everyone else, exactly. That's a better way of saying it.
In this crazy world of COVID-19 and protests to change things, an election year, what worries you the most about your portfolio?
I think fundraising, it has become increasingly difficult. There are definitely people still investing at the moment, but as you can imagine, a lot of big investors have kind of taken a step back and rolled back their investment pace. So the criteria and the bar for meeting follow-on investments is going to be higher. Not only that, the valuations have come down as well. So from my perspective, I've seen valuations come down anywhere from 20 to 50% in some cases at the seed stage. And that effect is going to be amplified at the Series A stage, where some of my portfolio companies have reached, but others still need to get to. So one thing that I'm focused on is how to best position my portfolio companies to raise that fair valuations ideally pre-COVID, that's what I define as fair, maintain a strong ownership for my founders and secure follow-on capital to extend our runway.
That's pretty interesting. Yeah, we've actually seen, we discussed this last week, but there was a recent report about VC funding globally, and it also, and it looks like it only went down less than 7% from the first half of 2020 to the, or rather from the first half of 2019 to the first half of this year. But I have seen metrics that indicate that at least valuations have come down. So the calculus has become a bit more investor friendly rather than founder friendly.
That sounds right to me. I would say people are less inclined to invest at like definitely pre-COVID valuations. Valuations have dropped significantly, and that part it's more that part than worrying about getting to the table, getting in conversation with these investors.
Yeah, that makes sense. Any prediction for fintech or investing for the next say 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, I think investors will be more wary of investing in capital-intensive businesses. So, as you probably noticed, like over the past 5 years, there's been sort of a scramble to invest in capital-intensive businesses that need a lot of capital to scale. Best example of this is WeWork. You know, capital-intensive businesses, they have bigger moats, so investors think that there's more defensibility there. But nobody expected COVID to come around. And when you have something like COVID hit, you realize how important runway is. And your runway, if you're at WeWork and your revenue drops 80%, your runway is going to be significantly shorter. Your net burn is going to go through the roof. So I think over the next 6 to 12 months, investors are going to be more and more worried about investing in businesses that require significant capital to scale, because one, maybe it's harder to get funding at the proper valuations, and then two, if something else like COVID hits, or even a second, third wave of COVID hits, we will see these businesses go belly up.
Yeah, so I see a lot of your investments are in Southeast Asia and in India here. Any particular one that you're excited about?
Yeah, MoneyView specifically was an investment that we made back at my former firm. They're the largest personal finance management app in India with over 10 million users. They enable users to kind of track expenses, manage bills, check balances, record cash expenses. The second portion of the company is direct-to-consumer loans. So users can apply for digital loans via their online platform, and MoneyView uses machine learning to analyze and underwrite these loans. And these models are proven to be more effective than India's credit bureaus at underwriting. And they're the only lending platform in India that provides a loan to users without needing physical visits. And the reason why this is, I think it's so disruptive, is India is traditionally a very underserved market when it comes to loans. Most banks focus only on the top 10 to 15% of credit. So there's really no subprime consumer loan market in India. 75% of loans are in the subprime market are driven by family and friends. In addition, like the credit bureaus in India have only been around for 10 years, and the traditional mechanism for underwriting is really inefficient. So I think what MoneyView is doing is they're coming in with a wealth of knowledge around underwriting. So they have an underwriting advantage. And then two, they're servicing a population that they understand more than the banks and credit bureaus there. And I think that advantage allows them to scale exponentially, especially in a population as large as India.
Yeah, that's exciting to see. I like to see where there's an underserved market that's finally getting a solution that works for them.
Definitely. I think it's great for society. It's great for underserved populations. And at the same time, the company becomes big off of a good mission. That's one huge criteria with all the companies I invest in, that they do good in the world. Actually, one, they have the ability to scale to $1 billion in valuation. But two, on the way there, they're doing a lot of good in the world. So companies like TradeUp exemplify that mission.
Well, thanks, Charles. That was very interesting, some great insights. And I would love if you invested in my company, because you just sound so calm. You sound so unflappable. I think even if you were giving me bad news, I wouldn't mind as much.
Oh, I appreciate that. And definitely, let's talk. Still doing deals, and somebody your caliber, I would definitely love to get to know and potentially fund as well.
Well, be great to keep in touch. All right. That's Charles Yu, an angel investor with some insights on the world of fintech and investing. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.